Welcome to the Eco News Report. My name is Tom Wheeler, and I'm your host. And I'm joined by my friends and colleagues, Matt Simmons of the Environmental Protection Information Center. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom.
Jen Colt of Humboldt Baykeeper. Hey, Jen.
Hey, everybody.
Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
Scott Greason of Friends of the Yale River. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Tom. Hi, everybody.
All right, so today we're going to do a little bit of a popcorn roundtable to just give updates on what our groups are working on these days. You know, despite us having a podcast together, having a radio show together, we often don't just find the time to sit down and chat about what each of our organizations are doing. So this is going to be good. I am deeply interested in the Bay, in the Eel River, in the North Coast, so I'm excited to learn more. All right. Jen, I will throw it to you first. I hear that you have some updates on a mercury study in Humboldt Bay that Baykeeper has been working on. What's going on with Baykeeper?
That is true. We are nearing the end of our second mercury study of fish, and this round is focused on mostly on the rockfish and lingcod and Pacific halibut that people love to eat from the coastal waters. And we've had a little bit of a delay because of the pandemic, and that is looking like we are not going to be able to test lamprey with the Wiat tribe because of the timing of when they're caught. But the news on that front is that since we started this study, it was brought to our attention by one of the consulting scientists that we're working with, that selenium levels can actually have a huge impact on mercury impacts if you're eating high mercury fish.
So, like, is that the selenium in the fish itself makes it more biodigestible? Or is it like, if I eat a lot of selenium in my diet somehow otherwise, then I am more susceptible to mercury intake?
That is a good question that I don't fully understand, but my understanding from what I've learned about it so far is that if the selenium levels in the fish are high, then the mercury impacts of eating that fish are buffered somewhat. If selenium levels are very low, the mercury impacts to the people eating the fish are exacerbated, and we have very low selenium levels in the soils around in Humboldt County, and the livestock have selenium deficiencies. So we thought this would be important to test because we're coming up with some species of fish that are really quite high in mercury levels, in particular the larger lingcod and lots of the older rockfish. And so we thought it would be important to test for selenium. So we did manage to find some funding to do those selenium tests on the same samples. So that'll be very interesting. And we should have that report sometime in late spring or so.
So for mercury, why is this such an important issue? And how is it related to issues like environmental justice?
Well, mercury
is bad for us. I think that we all kind of generally know that. I don't particularly know why it's bad for me. I just know I'm not supposed to have it. And if I'm a pregnant woman, I'm definitely not supposed to have it.
Right. It has much worse impacts on fetuses and children. It basically causes developmental disabilities, and it can also cause cancer, nerve dysfunction, all kinds of bad things. And so most Americans get mercury from eating fish. That's our biggest exposure route for mercury. And so it's an environmental justice issue because oftentimes ethnic minorities and low-income populations tend to eat a lot more fish than the average white American. And so, you know, like with a lot of tribal members, like in the Yurok tribe, it's not uncommon for people to eat salmon 28 times a month. Well, luckily, Chinook salmon is safe to eat 28 times a month. But fish like leopard sharks and, as I said, lingcod and some of the rockfish are very high in mercury. And leopard shark in particular is so high that nobody should be eating leopard shark at all from Humboldt Bay. So that's what got us started with this study, really, is leopard shark from Humboldt Bay was found to have the highest mercury levels in all the coastal fish in California that were sampled.
And I think that you previously put out a guide in both English and Spanish about the number of meals per month, I believe it was, that you should eat for various types of fish found in Humble Bay. Where could somebody find that information? If you are a fisherman and you're concerned about not wanting to poison your family, it's something I think that we're all probably concerned with. How can we find out more about what is a safe level of fish to eat?
We have a 2-page guidelines on our website. It's in Spanish, English, and also in Hmong. And there's lots of good news. So it's not just bad news. There are lots of fish and shellfish that are very low in mercury and are safe to eat and safe to feed your children. So it's really important to, if you are either someone who eats a lot of local fish or someone who catches a lot of local fish and gives it away to your family and friends, it's really good to be aware of what sort of fish are safe to eat, how many times a week, actually.
Jen, do we know who the main contributors are to the amount of mercury in Humboldt Bay?
We don't. We don't know what the local source might be. In most California waters, a mercury source is gold mining. But mercury was not known to be used in gold mining in the Eel River watershed, which is where most of the sediment in Humboldt Bay reportedly comes from. It is, at this point, the only real hypothesis is that it is from atmospheric deposition from coal-burning power plants around the world. And there is the special circumstances in Humboldt Bay mud where there's all this biota that's methylating the mercury at more rapid rates is what is causing the high levels of mercury here. In contrast with, say, Santa Monica Bay, where there's known mercury dumps from chemical manufacturing, how is it that leopard shark here have much higher mercury levels? It's really important for people to understand, too, the reason leopard shark are so high in mercury is they are long-lived and they eat very high in the food chain. So if you don't really know the mercury levels in the fish, you want the smaller fish, younger fish, and those that are eating lower on the food chain, like Chinook salmon, for example. They're shorter lived and they eat lower on the food chain in the early part of their life before they go out into the ocean. They're just eating plants. So that's why they have such low mercury levels.
Scott?
I wanted to add a little piece of evidence to that story, which is that we do now know that there was at least one mercury mine in the Upper Eel above Scott Dam and the Lake Pillsbury Reservoir. We were really alarmed to learn that the fish with the highest level of mercury in its flesh in statewide freshwater monitoring was found in the Lake Pillsbury Reservoir. That was a largemouth bass with a really high level of mercury. So we were really concerned about the potential for the sediments under that reservoir to have a bunch of mercury in them. And thanks to the Coastal Conservancy, we were able to get some sampling done last year that showed apparently that there's very little mercury in the sediments under Lake Pillsbury. So that's the good news. But it does suggest that, you know, one potential vector for the mercury in Humboldt Bay could be that mercury mine, mercury being pumped down the Eel.
So, Scott, I think that this is a good transition to what's going on at Friends of the Eel River. Do you have any more updates for us on things like the Eel River?
Yeah.
I crack myself up.
You're hilarious. The big story, of course, right now is what's happening with the two dams of the Potter Valley Project, Scott Dam and Cape Horn Dam, and the associated diversion from the Eel to the Russian River. The big story from the last several years has been that five entities, the Sonoma Water, the Mendocino County Inland Water and Power Commission, Caltrout, Humboldt County, and the Round Valley Indian Tribes, have joined together to attempt to relicense the Potter Valley Project with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. This is an effort that we have supported because it is an attempt to implement the two-basin solution that Jared Huffman has proposed, which is basically a deal to remove Scott Dam in return for us agreeing to maintain that diversion to the Russian River. I got to say, though, we're getting pretty exasperated. This relicensing effort is looking increasingly like a big stall tactic, and an effort to just maintain the status quo, keep Scott Dam, keep Cape Horn Dam, and maintain that diversion. So I'm getting pretty fed up and moving increasingly to a place where I see not relicensing, but moving to the surrender and decommissioning process before FERC as the path that's most likely to get us to dam removal. And those of you who've been following the long and hopefully happy Klamath dam removal story will get that that story happened under the surrender and decommissioning path. And, you know, that's where I think we're going to go very likely in the next year. As of now, the five parties are proceeding with a plan to basically continue the study plans that are necessary to relicense, but they have no money to do the study plans. And PG&E has made it very clear that it's not going to pay for those study plans or the relicensing. So this just leaves us looking at a long walk off a short pier at this point. So stay tuned.
So is there anything that's going to change with the Biden administration and FERC, perhaps FERC appointees, that could alter some of the dynamics with dam removal, both for the Klamath Dam and for the Eel River?
There are some things that could change that will definitely be for the better. We're hopeful that we'll see some real prioritization under the Biden administration of dam removal in general. There probably will be additional FERC appointments in the spring of 2021. But the really important thing about the FERC as a commission, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is that they agreed to the deal that the Klamath folks cut with Warren Buffett and company. And that was basically, you know, the staff of FERC said, you're going to have a co-license agreement with the utility here. You're going to have them maintain a license while you do dam removal, belt, suspenders, and a set of diapers. And the deal that the Klamath folks worked out with Warren Buffett and company was, no, we are not going to do that co-licensing. And they took that to the FERC commissioners, and the FERC commissioners were like, okay, sounds good to us, which tells us some important things. One, that when you are Warren Buffett or the CEO of a utility, you get a different kind of justice than everybody else appearing before FERC. And two, that it doesn't really matter whether we're talking about Republicans or Democrats here. They're willing to do whatever the utilities want. So that's not the big change that needs to happen. I do think that we are much more likely to be able to proceed with dam removal under a Biden administration for a lot of reasons we've already seen. You know, the original Klamath deal fell apart in Congress because Republicans hated it and wouldn't support it. Democrats are going to be much less likely to sabotage a dam removal deal just on ideological grounds. But, you know, basically what we're going to have is a sort of neutral administration of justice, not a real advocacy for removal of deadbeat dams, which is, of course, what we need.
Right, of course. Welcome to the Eco News Report. Today, we're going to do a little bit of a popcorn roundtable to just give updates on what our groups are working on these days. Well, I will go next with a little update from Epic, which is on Richardson Grove. So we had some bad news in December. The Ninth Circuit reversed our previous win before the Northern District Court of California and found that Caltrans had taken a hard look at the likely impacts to old growth redwoods from a couple of different things, like putting pavement over their roots and potential root suffocation. So we have a narrow loss at the Ninth Circuit. I want to reassure everybody that this doesn't mean that the project is going to start tomorrow. We still have more claims that were never litigated at the Northern District Court of California. So this is our federal lawsuit, I should also say. And we also have a state lawsuit. So previously, we went before the Northern District and we put forward all of these different claims, Endangered Species Act claims, NEPA, National Environmental Policy claims. We exhausted everything that we could possibly bring. And the court said, well, I don't need to reach those other issues because I'm going to only focus on these NEPA ones, and you win on these NEPA, so that's a win, and I'm not going to touch the others. So we still have all of those other claims left to pursue. We also have a victory in state court at the Humboldt County Superior Court from 2019 before Judge Kelly Neal. And Judge Neal said that Caltrans had put in some significant new information into the public record, and that the public was therefore eligible to review, critique, and comment on that new information. And Caltrans still hasn't provided a public comment period for that significant new information. So we are very far away from having any sort of legal resolution of the Richardson Grove project. The other big update on Richardson Grove is, for the first time in the history of the project, we actually have some votes by the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors against the project. So this came at a board meeting on Tuesday, December 15th, where two supervisors, Supervisor Steve Madrone and Supervisor Mike Wilson, both voted against the project and expressed their desire to pull county support from the project. Even though we lost, in some sense, we had three votes in favor of the project, there was an amendment to their statement of support, which I think is an important one. So although the Board of Supervisors said that they support the project, that support is contingent on an understanding that the project would have no effect on old growth redwoods, which I think shows that the Board of Supervisors hasn't really been paying attention to what Caltrans has said about the project, because Caltrans admits there's going to be pretty significant impacts to old growth redwoods. They're just not going to physically cut one down, you know, at the stump. They're going to cut into the root system, and this is going to result in significant dieback of the crown, because if you cut the roots of a plant, it's going to be affected. And so I think this no effect language, together with a new supervisor coming in for the second district in Michelle Bushnell, I think that this revives hope that we can sink local support for the project. And if we sink local support for the project, I think that that is probably the end of the Richardson Grove project, given all the controversy over the project, given the increasingly steep price tag and the various other needs for that same money in transportation planning up here on the North Coast. I think that it probably suffers a quiet death if we were to get the Board of Supervisors to vote against the project. So that's what I'm going to be devoting my early 2021 efforts towards. It's been 13 years that we have fought and bickered over this project, and I hope to not make it any more than 14. So, you know, my New Year's resolution, I'll say it on the radio, is to once and forever be done with the stupidity of the Richardson Grove project. All right, I'm gonna pass the mic now to Larry Glass. Larry, what's going on at the North Coast Environmental Center?
Well, real quick before I get into that, I just wanted to ask you a question. Are you going to ask for an in-bank, or however you say that, a hearing with the Ninth Circuit?
Yeah, so we're still considering our legal options, but we're certainly going to ask for a rehearing of some sort. So we have two different options for a rehearing at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on their decision in the Richardson Grove case. One is a rehearing by the same panel of judges that heard the case in the first place. And we think that the judges made some assumptions and made some errors that they might want to correct. So we're going to point those out to that same panel. And then we can also ask for the whole Ninth Circuit, 11-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit, because the Ninth Circuit's so ridiculously big. We can ask for an 11-judge panel to do what's called an en banc review, which could reverse the 3-judge panel that reversed our win at the Northern District. So, you know, even at our federal court level, even with this L, the loss at the Ninth Circuit, it's still months away from even that being resolved. So for anybody who is concerned about the old growth redwoods at Richardson Grove State Park, there's likely years of litigation before Caltrans could ever get the green light to go ahead. And then Caltrans would still need to come up with $21 million to do the project, which they don't have budgeted. So again, the Grove is safe for now, but that's a big for now. So everyone continue to reach out to the supervisors, especially reach out to Supervisor-elect Bushnell. I had a conversation with her. I thought that she was a really thoughtful person from my conversation, and she said that she was interested in hearing from her constituents on this issue. She's doing the studies now about what her position on this project should be. So everybody reach out to her. Jen, what's up?
I just noticed, you know, I'm no attorney, as you all know, but I teach environmental impact assessment at Humboldt State University. And I did look at the decision and I found it really interesting that one of the statements by the judge was there's no evidence supporting the district court's assumption that 50% paving over root zones is some sort of threshold of significance, and that this was a misreading of evidence in the record. And so any of my former students in this environmental science and management class will know what this means, the threshold of significance, how much damage is considered significant under environmental law is the debate here. And so that's important to get your thresholds right, students.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Larry, now we'll popcorn over to you. What's going on at the North Coast Environmental Center these days?
Well, there's lots of things, but I'm going to focus on my work in the national forests right now. The August Complex fire is still casting a heavy shadow on everything. The Forest Service is putting together its plan for its after-fire action. Engaged with them, still not clear to us exactly what their plan is. By the time this show airs, we'll have had a meeting with them and they will have divulged a little more of their plan, but it's still not clear. They have pooled the three forests together, Mendocino, Six Rivers, and Shasta Trinity, to sort of act in concert with each other, which I don't think is a good thing personally, but that's what their plan is.
That sort of pooling of resources can only mean that they're probably looking at something big if they think that they need all that planning staff.
Yeah, or they've just managed to whittle down their planning staff to the point where they have to share the three forest planning staff.
That too.
The other thing that, you know, so we're deeply engaged in that, and I'm really watching to make sure that people just don't make the same old mistakes they've made in the past. People have to realize that the conditions in the forest have dramatically changed in the last decade. And what would have worked a decade ago is just not going to work anymore. The fuel loading situation, the hot weather and the dry spell that just continues to get bigger and bigger is just changing the dynamics in the forest. And I think that we've been very conifer centric in Northern California. I think we're going to have to step away from that and start thinking about our friends, the hardwood trees, and how resilient they are in the face of climate change, and start thinking a little bit more about promoting their existence in the future instead of just going in and saying, oh, okay, we need to replant conifers in here again, because I'm not sure that's going to work. The other thing we're looking at real closely is in Trinity County, we have a utility district that was set up at the time of the building of the dam, the Trinity Dam. It's Trinity Public Utility District. And they're able to provide electricity at very cheap rates to Trinity County residents. And so they're held in high regard in Trinity County. But they're just about ready to embark on over 300 miles of their power line distribution lines and creating a 300-foot wide clear cut, basically, along all these power lines in the name of forest fire prevention. And we're just not sure, we're not happy about the concept of that much clear cutting going on, because we know that they're not going to have the wherewithal to maintain those. It's going to come back in brush, and then they're going to want to spray them with herbicides. It's just buying, trading one problem for another, it seems like to us. So we're watching that one real closely. So those are the two big forest issues that I've got on my plate.
It's alarming to think that we are now having to have the conversation about climate change and long-term forest composition and whether we're going to have stand conversion. We always think about the North Coast as the lush green conifer paradise. And for us to start looking more like Napa County or somewhere further south, that might be the future. That's the cost of a warming planet, is the normal is going to change. All right. Well, thank you, Larry. Good luck. And let us know if you need any help on any of the things you're working on.
Will do.
Matt, I know that you're working on the Jackson Demonstration State Forest. This is kind of a weird one, right? What is the Jackson Demonstration State Forest and what's going on over there?
Yeah. So the Jackson Demonstration State Forest is a state-owned forest. California purchased it in 1947 after it had been heavily logged by the Casper Lumber Company. And California's intention when they bought it was to have it be a place to demonstrate advanced forestry. They were going to show everyone how it's done when it came to timber production. And over time, they've done a fair amount of logging in the forest, but they've also left a lot of it unlogged. And so because some areas were last logged over 90 years ago, this forest is starting to become, you know, it's a second growth forest, but it's starting to take on some of the qualities of old growth forest.
It's the old growth of the future.
Exactly. And so EPIC is really concerned because CAL FIRE, which manages the forest, has proposed a lot of logging within that old growth of the future. And it's not just EPIC that's concerned. There's a lot of local community members who use the forest for recreation. There's mountain bikers, mushroom foragers. There's a summer camp within the forest. And all of these folk who live down in Mendocino County are going to have to deal with CAL FIRE logging their backyard, their forest that they use, that's public land, that it has a timber component, but it's also heavily used for recreation. And so we're looking into this, and we're really concerned about the logging that's going on. What really jumped out to me that we should be concerned about is that in the timber harvest plans that CAL FIRE has written up, the state requires people who want to conduct logging to talk about the greenhouse gas impacts of their logging. And EPIC is pretty used to seeing private timber companies borrow some language from the right wing when it comes to talking about greenhouse gas emissions. They'll deny climate change, or they'll say it's unclear what impacts there really are. But I'm reading through these timber harvest plans written by the state of California, and I come across here, I'll quote the line for you guys. Exactly how and to what extent human activity plays a role in global climate change appears to be unknown. That's from a state of California document filed in December 2020. And I just cannot believe that California is still doing this. And I think a lot of attention needs to be called to their lagging on this issue and their backwardness.
Governor Newsom, what are you going to do about this? You're ordering the state to have electric cars by 2035, and then your state is also denying climate change. That is outrageous.
Yeah, so there's a lot of community interest. EPIC has an action alert out that you can go to write to the Santa Rosa Review team regarding one of the current timber harvest plans, and hopefully there will be more to talk about soon.
All right, so go to wildcalifornia.org to find that action alert and to take action on this pretty egregious logging of our public lands, right? We should be managing public lands for carbon sequestration, for clean water, for wildlife. The idea that we need to demonstrate how to log, that's a pretty silly notion at this point. Thanks, Matt. Thanks, y'all. All right, this has been another episode of the Eco News Report. Thank you all for tuning in, and thank you to my wonderful colleagues and friends for joining me on today's show. If you have a topic you want to discuss on a future show, email me, tom@wildcalifornia.org, and join us on This Time and Channel next week for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.